Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.
Good afternoon. It's just gone 1 o'clock on a Tuesday. That means it's time for the Daily Maverick Show on Cliff Central. I'm your host, Tilly Haralambos, and I'm joined in studio by one of the more male panels and probably less pretty panels we've had in a long time. Yeah. Joined in studio by Simon Addison, our Chief Africa Correspondent, John Stupart, the man who wakes you up every morning with great news in the first thing editor, and Gushwell Brooks, our columnist at Daily Maverick. Welcome, gents.
Thank you.
Awesome.
Happy New Year. Compliments of the season and all that other malarkey. Let's get straight into things making news in first thing, John. Death and destruction awaits us?
Well, always, every week, you know, there's always going to be death and destruction. It's really just who's causing the death and who's doing the destruction that changes every so often. I think the biggest thing starting this week is the Charlie Hebdo headlines, which, if you know, unless you've been living under a rock today, and if you've seen any headlines anywhere, they're looking to, or they will be rather, publishing a cartoon of Muhammad on their front page, almost in, I suppose, direct defiance, I guess, of the attacks last week, which I guess is the whole point and principle of freedom of speech. It just would be very interesting to see what the reactions will be to do that. And then also carrying on with that, you also started to see in Germany, you have very, very bigoted, for lack of a better word. Well, there are better words, but you know, even on uncensored radio, I think I should censor myself. Protests, I guess, in Dresden, sort of protesting anti-Islamic sentiment and general xenophobia and awfulness, which seems very disturbing considering these are Germans who are doing it, and really the last time the Germans had a rally in Dresden, it kind of resulted in all sorts of invasions.
Yeah, even before the Paris attacks, we were seeing this an increased level of sentiment, anti-Islamic sentiment, marches and movements starting to gather pace in a lot of countries in Europe.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing is, Germany's never really been particularly great in terms of xenophobic reputation. They've always, even I remember in the early 2000s when I was studying Germany, hearing stories from my colored German lecturer talking about the victimization she experienced in a relatively low-income area in Germany, where you tend to get targeted simply because you look different, or even you just don't even look slightly German, which is a very, very difficult kind of thing to square when Germans, or you know, local original Germans, for lack of a better word, start pinpointing or pigeonholing people simply because they're not, I'm not going to say Aryan, but I think I just did, kind of profiles. It's very disturbing to see how little Germany's progressed.
John, do you think that there are parallels between the sort of pre-1945 demonization of Jews and the Jewish religion, and the sort of civilizational clash that people like Hitler espoused, and the way the narrative is going on Islam at the moment? I don't know. Is it almost a setup for something similar to happen?
I certainly think it's quite disturbing when you see the reprisal attacks. I saw a map, I think it was the New York Times, if I remember correctly, talking or just illustrating the number of attacks and the type of attacks against Muslim or Muslim-related establishments, people, and things like that. And that's just in France, let alone these rallies we now see in Germany. That said, I don't think it's cause for alarm just yet. I'm probably hamming up the Nazism too much here, because when you look at the pro-freedom of speech rallies in Paris and the rest of France, you're looking at 3 million people, which is a hell of a lot more than the 25,000 people organized by a crazy right-wing socialist party or national socialist party.
The thing is, you only need a couple to go crazy, as we saw last week in Paris, for bad things to happen.
And also, sorry, Gershwell.
What I'm really worried about is that there's a conflation now of, on the one end, which is a valid argument in terms of freedom of expression, and on the other hand, people then using that to increase the amount of Islamophobia going around us. Because, I mean, what you just mentioned there about Charlie Hebdo, the real question is that, yes, I'm all for freedom of expression. That's why I'm sitting here. But the real issue is, what are you trying to prove by going again and putting the Prophet Muhammad on your front page?
No, and I agree. And I think you can't say that the small neo-Nazi type marches are necessarily diametrically opposed to the multi-million freedom of expression ones, because, I mean, the people in that Paris march, some of those world leaders in attendance. Ali Bongo Ondimba of Gabon was one example. Benjamin Netanyahu, another example.
Mahmoud Abbas was there.
Mahmoud Abbas. I think someone said Sisi was there, the Egyptian president.
Great.
You know, for them, that was not a march about freedom of expression. That was a march against terrorism, specifically Islamist terrorism.
Yes, absolutely. And I think to broaden the thing as well, when you start looking at Germany itself, Germany isn't necessarily fostering this anti-Islamic or Islamophobic attitude so much as it's starting to incubate a wholesale xenophobic kind of attitude. Whereas I think in Paris, the reprisals, I suspect, I mean, I have absolutely no substantiation for this, but I get the impression it's limited and it will fizzle out as the year progresses, barring, God forbid, any other attacks in Paris. Whereas in Germany, this is simply just another flashpoint in quite a long or sort of history, at least in the 21st century, of German xenophobia, which I think is a bit more systemically disturbing than what's happening in France.
Just getting back to the cover that Charlie Hebdo are running on this current edition that's going out now. It's going out to 3 million. They're doing a print run of 3 million, which is 50 times bigger than their normal print circulation. On the back of it, we've had different responses from different publications around the world in carrying that cover on their pages. I believe the New York Times declined to run the cover. The Guardian did, in the interest of it being such a newsworthy topic. But there were different responses, people saying, you know, we're not going to partake in that. We believe in the freedom of speech, but we're not going to run those covers.
But Steely, you know, I'm going to go back to a fundamental question here, right? So, and yes, maybe we're putting, it's not just about freedom of expression, but it also then becomes an issue of people's right to freely express themselves religiously, right? And in Islam, it's forbidden to make any images of the Prophet whatsoever for religious reasons. So what is the statement you're making then as a non-Muslim by saying that, you know, we are going to print this anyway? Because the issue is that we need to ask ourselves, is the enemy then Islam? Or is the enemy the Boko Harams and the Al-Shababs and, you know, the ISISs of the world and the Al-Qaedas? Because if those are your enemies, then what business do you have putting the Prophet on the cover? And don't get me wrong, I really feel for the guys when it comes to the Charlie Hebdo issue. And I don't think that killing 12 people and wounding 11 people is the obvious response. Of course not. But for goodness sake, what are you guys, I mean, isn't there something called being responsible in this field?
Well, then there's also the question of, you know, then take that up. Take that up with Ombudsman. Take that up with the Constitution of France.
I agree.
And they did, and they failed, and they were rejected, and they kicked out. And that's why Charlie Hebdo continued to do that, is because the laws of France allow them to do that. And that, unfortunately, is only going to leave, you know, in my mind, peaceful protest outside Charlie Hebdo's office with placards and stuff instead of gun-wielding, crazy extremists. Also comes back to an interesting article I read, and this was from 10 years ago. It's like, Islamic fundamentalist extremism, where does it come from? You know, and that was the question of this article, and saying, okay, why is it that we have extremists who are part of this? Where does it come from? Why is it only
Twenty years ago we had genocide
in Serbia that was you know, called Christian genocide happening, you know, perpetrated by Christians. But the question coming back was, why is this happening? And it was interesting take on how Saudi Arabia's economic rise on the back of the demand for oil over the last 60, 70, 80 years helped them fund these schools that taught the extreme version and interpretations of Islam, and went around funding these schools, which then obviously grew on the back of all this funding, and that Saudi Arabia is pretty much at the center of this extremist interpretation. And that for me was quite interesting to see, where does it come from? Who's fostering this? Who's, you know, where,
and of course, where does Saudi Arabia's money come from?
You know, the West, the United States, almost. You know,
that's exactly what I was thinking. I was thinking, well, okay, sure, okay. Thanks for your money, look, but we actually hate you.
And then someone sorry, just gets back to a comment you made on one of a previous show where you compared Saudi Arabia, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, to be just as bad, if not worse, as ISIS. And then,
oh, I remember that. Yes, yes.
You guys had that.
John wasn't happy with me that day.
You know. Yes, I strangely had a similar argument yesterday with a friend of mine about, whether or not, you know, sort of state-sponsored terrorism is better than just uncontrolled chaotic terrorism. And it seems to be quite a theme that involves me, I guess.
I want to go back to the sort of this perception that religious fundamentalism is only Islamic, which is nonsense. I just don't get that, you know. Myanmar at the moment, there's some horrendous Buddhist pogroms going on against the Rohingya community in one of the remote areas of the country. Absolutely horrendous stuff. Very similar to what we're seeing in Nigeria, actually. The reports are the same. There's been plenty of violent Hindu nationalism as well. Mm-hmm. In the Central African Republic, does anyone remember Joseph Kony, who has not yet been stopped? He is head of the Lord's Resistance Army. Which Lord is that? That's the Christian God. So, you know, a lot of it is just how we report things, yeah. And the labels we choose to assign. So Joseph Kony's a rebel. He's not a terrorist.
Yeah. And people like him tend to just get forgotten. When invisible children make a big deal and they do a YouTube clip that the world watches and does nothing about, then Joseph Kony is a big issue. Then he's a big ticket item. But after that, stop him.
There's a lovely story, just going a slight diversion. The second in command of the Lord's Resistance Army has just been caught and handed over to the US. Now, he was captured by the Seleka rebels in the Central African Republic. Now, they are a Muslim rebel group that was largely responsible for causing the civil war in that country.
But also killing 15 South African soldiers.
And exactly. So, not exactly a nice bunch of guys. But they caught this guy, and they handed him over to the US. And now they're saying, well, there was a $5 million bounty on his head. So where's the money? Show us the money.
Pay back the money.
And Israeli, you may as well, at that point, be funding the Lord's Resistance Army. Yeah. Going to give $5 million to the Seleka rebels.
But Simon, this also comes back to the article you wrote a couple of days ago that got a lot of interest on Daily Maverick, comparing, but stating the facts that, you know, we had this terrible atrocity that happened in Paris, 17 people were killed, and we had this massive media scrutiny, live broadcast, the entire world was glued to their televisions watching, the sieges unfold. Mm. And then we had 2,000 people, an entire village was taken out by Boko Haram. And the media response to that was, was a drop in the ocean compared to what happened.
It was absolutely shameful. And, you know, we've got to look at ourselves as well. We're a media organization. Mm. At the Daily Maverick, we put a really fantastic editorial on our front page about the Paris massacres. Mm. And what it means for freedom of expression and standing up for that. And it was brilliant. But, you know, we haven't done anything similar for Nigeria or for sort of any African stuff.
And there are probably a couple of issues for that as well, as part of the greater sort of media scrutiny or coverage of that. I mean, it's difficult to cover those places. You've had, people in our field, when it was one of us, you cut one of us, we bleed as well.
Absolutely. There were various factors. But I mean, I think they're excuses. When you look at the numbers, 17 compared to 2,000. If you do the math, that's 133 Paris massacres compared to one Nigeria massacre. It's absolutely mental.
Doesn't that also tie in with the previous issue we were talking about with regards to this perception that, you know, when an Islamic extremist attacks a Western target, it's bigger news. That perception we have. But if you're the Lord's Resistance Army taking out, you know, African lives, not so much.
Well, I see it's news. Sorry to interrupt there. I mean, I see. I agree with that third point in that it's difficult to get information. But I think that stems from two other larger points. Was firstly that it's just inherently less sellable than European terrorism, because European terrorism is of interest to Europeans and Western audiences. And secondly, as well, I think. Mm. Africa in general, and yes, I'm going to put on my colonial hat here and blame it for a bit. Africa is perceived as this inherently violent place, so people are not surprised when 2,000 people are butchered and killed and raped. And thus, there is no interest in it, and thus there is no good sources or information because there's no media presence there.
I tend to agree with John, but I mean, just to go back to the massacre in Rwanda. About 2 decades ago, where a journalist made a very, very telling observation, where she actually said that when she saw all those dead bodies on the road, and I mean, we remember the visuals from Rwanda. It was horrific. People macheted to death, and their bodies just strewn all over the roads. And she saw all these bodies. I mean, kids, women, elderly people, the works. And she said she didn't shed a single tear. But 2 years prior to that, when she was in Bosnia, she was crying her eyes out.
Yeah,
and she said there's some, and that's when she realized, and maybe, I don't know, this is, I hope, not an unbecoming comment, but I think there's something about likeness as well. You know, when you look at someone, you can empathize with them. They look like you. You feel for them a little more than the guy.
Same upbringing, same cultural background.
Exactly, because, and then part of the European issue is that it wasn't expected. Who expected France, who expected two nutcases to grab AK-47s, storm a building, and kill 12 people? And wound 11. And then 2-3 days later, wreaked the havoc.
Well, actually, you say that. Who expects that? But when you look at some of the underlying issues, I mean, France has had a history of xenophobic violence. Islam is now, the 6 million practicing people within there. And those tensions...
And they're bombing terrorists around the world.
And they're bombing terrorists around the world. You're going to see some of those tensions. I mean, it's surprising in that they were... Well, and then you add, obviously, the Charlie Hebdo approach to treating Islam. Is it really surprising that it happened?
Yeah, exactly. I want to address what Gershel was saying about likeness. And I think you're exactly right. And it's a really uncomfortable territory for people to get into because it gets very racial very quickly. But, you know, it's something we need to address. But that explains, yes, why the sort of world media was so obsessed with Paris. But what about African media? I mean, that argument doesn't work in Nigeria. And I mean, in Nigeria, in Lagos, there was more coverage of Paris than there was of Baga. In Nigeria, in South Africa, fellow African country.
So, I mean, I think if I could maybe offer up a reason for the Nigerian lack of coverage, is that not really just showing themselves up, the lack of control that they have, and obviously the influence of the state and not embarrassing the state.
I think you don't give Nigerian journalists enough credit. There's some really good journalists and a vibrant press in Nigeria. It's very similar in many ways to South Africa. They're constantly looking at what their government's done wrong and what can be done to fix it and all that kind of stuff.
Well, surely certain segments, but isn't the majority then obviously influenced by the government as it is here? You know, the majority of the outlets, and in which
look,
case...
look at Marikana here. That received plenty of attention in the press. There is something more wrong in Nigeria. I don't think that the editors sit there and say, ooh, 2,000 people dead. I'm not going to publish the story because it makes my country look bad. I don't buy that. And I think that...
I suspect it might be something to do with the fact that Baga is... By if you're in Lagos or Abuja, Baga is miles and miles away. It doesn't exist in the urban Nigerian context where it's not like South Africa where if say for example 2,000 people were massacred in even Oranje for crying out loud, you know, some podunk backward little, you know, sort of slightly incestuous little town, that's going to be big news. That's going to be hell of a big news. Whereas in Nigeria. The north and south is already a huge split, and then you start looking at these tiny little villages where 2,000 people are killed. It has no bearing on the modern Lagos man, whereas, oh no, I have to cancel my trip to Paris, or my business or shopping trip. I think it sort of bears far more importance, and for good or for ill, I think that might be
And you can draw a parallel to the likeness part again. So if we take the TB Joshua catastrophe that happened, there was pretty good coverage in the South African. Eventually, it picked up a lot of steam. But, I mean, that was also because it was, you know, 80 of our own who had died. And, you know, so there is that. But, I mean, still at the end of the day, you're right. It's still 2,000 people massacred in an act of terrorism that should be completely blowing our minds and going out, our pages. But it's not.
But going back to Simon's article, I mean, the one thing that I picked up there was the fact that journalists were just not in the area as well. You know, they had to go there after the fact, assuming that they even went there.
No, they can't. The nearest journos are 600 kilometers away, and they still can't get in.
But the second point is that it again points how Nigeria, in as much as there are similarities in terms of, you know, both being the economic powerhouses of Africa and all that, these are two very different countries. You know, parts of Nigeria is as if government has lost complete and utter control of those parts of the country. And Baga especially. If you think about it, that's a part of Nigeria where the government has no hold over it. So no matter what Goodluck Jonathan says, and by the way, Goodluck Jonathan is saying what he's saying because he wants to win another election. But he has absolutely no control, and that is why Boko Haram is still a problem. And I think that will remain the fundamental issue. We'll keep on having these reports going 20 years now. Unless, of course, I think what's going to shake Boko Haram up, sadly enough, is if their current leader dies and then there's a leadership squabble and then they break into little splinters. That's what's going to bring Boko Haram to its knees.
But then say Boko Haram splits, you're still going to have something like the DRC where instead of, you know, one singular organization, you now have thousands of little rebel splinter groups running around basically acting as bandits. And there's no longer even this political ideological objective unifying them, and it becomes chaos.
But the point being that the Nigerian government just has absolutely no control when it comes to this issue. None whatsoever. So unfortunately, I don't see hope on the horizon either. And the real question that one needs to ask, though, is that, I mean, if you look at a Charlie Hebdo situation, there is light at the end of the tunnel. You know, this thing is going to be dealt with at one point or the other. Yes. So Charlie Hebdo is going to go ahead and they're going to print their cover. The French government is going to rally. They've promised that now they're going to join the Allegiance of the Willing or whatever they call themselves now.
Your internet browser history. It's time to start going through your browser history, cleaning it up because Big Brother French edition is going to start watching.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but with Nigeria, we're not going to see them.
You know, what I sort of the theory that I've been mulling over for a long time, and it's the kind of thing that would occupy a doctoral candidate for many, many years, and I certainly will never get to the bottom of it, but sort of this idea that the Western world, that we have, you know, we have this image of the Western world that, yes, of course, they're going to clean this up. They're going to sort this problem out. France is going to be fine. And the way that they do that is just to export the consequences somewhere else. Mm. You know, and I think that's what's going to happen. It has happened throughout French history. You know, the French wars, the territory that they've gained, the interventions, that is ultimately what led to the Charlie Hebdo, I think. You know, these guys were Algerian.
Mm.
What France did in Algeria was one of the greatest atrocities of the 20th century. Mm. And of
and
course,
also
this is not...
Film.
But it's interesting Algiers, that has not featured at all in the critique. This is, you know, it's all been about Islamic fundamentalism, not about blowback from the Algerian adventures.
When you talk about the Algerian adventures that one can date back to, say, 100 years, what about the current laws? I mean, you know, in the current state of the nation, you know? I mean, surely you need to start addressing the Islamophobia that we've been talking about, the xenophobia that we've been talking about, and some of the laws that prevent, I mean, something as basic as a woman not being allowed to wear hijab in public, you know, or veil. I mean,
it's crazy.
Really,
and you do wonder, you know, freedom of expression, is wearing a hijab not freedom of expression?
Exactly.
Well, I think I think it would be very hasty to assume that France is going to even potentially look at relaxing some of its harsh sort of mildly xenophobic laws, because I think you see in Australia, for example, the response to Islamic-based terrorism on Australia is to harden itself up.
Yeah, yeah.
Same as America. Mm. Homeland Security, for all its ills, has prevented a major attack, Boston bombings notwithstanding, on its shores. And there have been incidences where they preemptively arrested terrorists and combated it. And I think the end objective of liberalizing your society, and bear in mind, France is already fairly liberal as far as Western democracies go, the results are not known, whereas the outcomes for hardening your society, enforcing immigration controls, putting CCTV cameras everywhere, profiling, all those kind of things, does unfortunately yield some manner of protection while still allowing them their expeditionary counter-terror capability. And I think that's a very disturbing thing if France starts to just follow the British and American model, because I think that would be, I think France would lose a hell of a lot of its own characteristic or character in the process.
Not to labor the point, John, and Steely, I promise you this is the final one I'm going to make, the final point I'm going to make on this, is that, look, unfortunately, and this is uncensored radio, you're just going to end up pissing people off a little more, right? Because what you're doing is that you're basically saying that, guys, you are different, and because you're different, we're going to treat you differently, and we're going to scrutinize you more. And what that does then is that if there's a young bloke, and that's what we're seeing the rise of now, these two brothers were, for all intents and purposes, lone wolves, right? The Boston bombing guys, lone wolves as well. Yes, there was an ideology, but it's not as if they had an HQ that they needed to report back to and explain what their plan was going to be. They decided to execute on their own.
Sure, they were lone wolves, but they were trained.
They were trained.
They're both Boston bombers, and these guys went and got formal training.
But
from some kind of organized terrorist cell.
But Homeland Security, intelligence, didn't pick up chatter because they didn't have to go and communicate with someone sitting, I don't know, in the desert somewhere in Afghanistan, and then double check with them if our next move is going to be fine. They went ahead and did the stuff anyway.
Well, someone was.
The only way this stuff rises up is that, well, I'm sitting here, I'm being treated differently, I'm getting disenfranchised, it's really starting to work on my nerves, I'm going to do something about it. And the unfortunate backlash is this type of stuff is going to, I really predict that this stuff is going to, we're going to see a little more of this stuff happening.
Well, to play devil's advocate, I don't endorse this policy at all, but I do think that hardening your country as a counter-terror security state does work, though. I mean, yes, you will radicalize a hell of a lot more people. You will piss off a hell of a lot more people, but you will also have a hell of a lot more security or freedom of force, you know, police, security forces, intelligence, surveillance, and all those kinds of things, which means you can conduct a hell of a lot more interventions before it gets to this. I think part of the problem with these attackers is that the one of the brothers had served time in prison. He was under surveillance. Ooh. The Americans knew of him as well. I mean, God, the Americans know of it as well. So I think the problem is the French intelligence simply just couldn't handle all of these things because they don't have the powers or the autonomy that America has to deal with these things. And I think at least President Hollande is going to be having or asking some very, very searching questions about, do we go that way where you have a fairly good chance of being able to, yes, you lose all of these social freedoms, and I fully agree on that. I think that's an awful thing, an awful way to go. But at the same time, there's an assured outcome at the end, relatively speaking.
Is there, though, John? Is there? I mean, this is an age where pretty much, you know, look at America, anyone can walk into a shop and buy a gun. America may succeed in preventing an attack this year or next year, but they won't the year after that. At some point, someone will break through those defenses. And the cost of those defenses is to restrict the freedoms and rights of hundreds of millions of people.
Absolutely.
I'm not sure that trade-off works for me.
Well, no, I don't think it works for anyone other than, you know, the governments involved. I mean, I'm thinking, yes, there will be another attack, but there certainly won't be another 9/11.
Yeah.
You know, I imagine getting checks and trying to learn how to fly an aeroplane, for example, is a hell of a lot more difficult. Yeah. Yes, you can buy a gun in America, anywhere in the, you know, in a supermarket and all that with very minimal checks. But the downside is if you take that gun and go in a shooting spree, most other Americans have guns themselves. And you end up in this horribly escalated situation. But at the end of the day, it does lend to some sort of weird, chaotic self-policement.
Wasn't that a case in the cinema shooting about a year or two ago, where I think it was in Texas, where the guy had opened fire and killed a couple of the moviegoers, but he was taken down himself by another guy who was packing heat in the cinema.
I am a Magnum 45. Yeah.
I'm going to go catch me a little bit of Dumb and Dumber too. Make sure I'm a Smith and Wesson.
The movie in question was actually The Rise of the Dark Knight, or What the Dark Knight Returns. That was the movie in question.
Yeah. And to invoke a quote by the Admiral Yamamoto from World War II, his very famous Japanese admiral, he said, "We could never invade the homeland of the United States because you'd find a rifle underneath every blade of grass." And I think that's the way America's gone. It's just completely weaponized.
Crazy.
Another point on Charlie Hebdo, it was interesting to see the police commissioner of France committed suicide after the...
Oh, really?
Sure. I did not see that.
I saw that.
Really?
Shot himself after that, just overcome with I don't know, maybe the deficiencies in you know, that they could have done more to prevent it or the grief. But that was quite interesting and obviously sad to see.
It's almost like a Japanese harakiri kind of,
it's a very Japanese kill yourself kind from of shame. Approach to go, yeah.
And and the other one that is now starting to, and obviously going back to our friends in Saudi Arabia, is looking at the price of oil, which Goldman Sachs are expecting in the next 90 days to hit $40 a barrel. The knock-on effect for us is that the petrol price comes down, and obviously helps with the cost of living everywhere around the world.
Now, I guarantee you'll
still pay the same. Do you know what would be the appropriate song to play now?
What would that be?
Red Hot Chili Peppers, Road Trippin'.
The last time we tried to play an appropriate song for a news item we were discussing, we got a little bit, got a little bit of backlash for. So we don't do that anymore. Oil going down to $40 a barrel is off the back of OPEC, the oil-producing countries, who are trying to put the shale producers in America out of business. Shale gas has almost single-handedly turned around the American economy over the last couple of years. It's added something like 1 million jobs to the American economy. And it's also turned America from being a net importer of oil to now being a net exporter of oil, now, which has major significance and consequences. One of which, from an African perspective, we saw Nigeria, on the back of their oil production and exports to America, became the biggest economy in Africa on the back of that. That now has almost been wiped away because America aren't buying oil from Nigeria. So if they do ever restate that in less than 10 years, we might again become the biggest.
Angola as well is a huge exporter of oil to the United States.
But so this battle between OPEC and the shale producers to see how they can flood the market and drive down the price of oil and obviously try and kill these shale producers got me thinking, would America's non-dependence on oil, which is now a new set of circumstances and reality for the first time, would that change its foreign policy to Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely.
Because they've pretty much been allowed to get away with murder in a lot of circumstances. And, a lot of the terror, Bin Laden was Saudi Arabian. We've got how many beheadings did Saudi Arabia perpetrate last year? Human rights atrocities. We've got this example of a blogger who now has been imprisoned for something like 10 years and for the next 20 weeks will be receiving 50 lashes. So every week for the next 20 weeks because he criticized Islam. And that just doesn't go down well in Saudi Arabia. And this comes back to those extreme schools teaching those extreme versions and interpretations of Islam. So I was just wondering, if we no longer reliant on Saudi oil, will the Western powers, will America take a different stance on their human rights abuses?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you, Simon.
Very simple answer.
Okay. I shall explain myself. The question we have to ask ourselves is why, what's America doing in the Middle East? Are they there to export fundamental Western values such as human rights, freedom of expression, democracy? Or are they there for more strategic purposes? I would argue the latter. You see no evidence of America trying really to export democracy anywhere successfully. Now, I think we have already seen a change in policy after the oil price decline, a change of American policy. We've seen that with all this ISIS stuff going on in Iraq, America hasn't really got involved. They've done a bit, but they've kind of done the bare minimum that they need to try and keep things relatively stable. There have been no, massive troops on the ground, no expending of hundreds of billions of dollars in another actual war to sort this problem out. I think if ISIS had happened 5 years ago, it would have been a very, very different situation. Now, when it comes to Saudi, you got to ask yourselves, what would it cost? So if America starts saying to Saudi, well, you need to buck up and, stop killing people, stop sponsoring terrorism, all this kinds of thing. What would it cost America? Well, it would cost America their main ally in the Middle East. And yes, shale gas is working now. But, you got to play the long game as a country. You're talking decades and decades. Why on earth would you alienate one of your most dependable allies that happens to be sitting on one of the world's greatest reserves of energy. I think for the moment, if I was an American policymaker, I would still be trying to make friends with Saudi Arabia as much as I could.
I think I agree with you fully on that regard. I think also when you start looking at American shale gas industry, it's heavily, heavily subsidized. It's not this all wonderful miracle of providing free or virtually free energy to Americans, because it's costing the American state a hell of a lot of money. And, you know, the gas tends to get, in terms of reserves, at least in the American reserves, it's not going to last nearly as long as it's, as oil or extractive industries elsewhere. You're talking about the hydrocarbons. So I think when you start looking at oil imports into America, I think America will in the future certainly look towards other countries again for importing oil, particularly if there's another financial crisis, for example. I think there's already a lobby for lowering the subsidization of shale gas and thus increasing the price of gas-based energy in America. And that will have a knock-on effect in terms of buying oil or importing oil back into the States. Whether or not it'll go back to Saudi Arabia, I'm not sure, because I think America's smarter than that, and I think they're actually trying to broaden their foreign policy in this regard, which is why you see they're, well, now next to China, they're the number two importer of oil from Angola, which, if I remember correctly, is actually an OPEC member for some weird reason that I don't quite understand. But they do still have these relatively unstable countries in their books. But I think the move to Saudi Arabia, I think, will not happen as big as it did probably in the 20th century. That said, I certainly could see them coming back with their hose pipe ready to siphon the oils.
A scary thought. The last time oil dropped by this much in this short a period of time was just before the 2008 financial crisis. And people are starting to get very shivery and scary thoughts about a repeat of those circumstances as well.
So you're saying it was a good decision.
Steely always sees the light at the end of the tunnel.
So go long on those short positions.
Or take the road trip now while your savings are worth a day.
Interesting segment I saw on the Vice news program the other day was that the oil deposits in the North Pole are actually the biggest on Earth, and that is now starting to generate a lot of interest from all the countries who can lay claim to those territories.
Yeah, to put on my warmongering cap, I think that could potentially be one of the bigger major points of conflict or crises in our time, in our generation. You've got your Nordic nations who are not necessarily going to side with NATO or European Union political interests with regard to those rather significant oil resources there. You see, Russia's already planted a flag underneath there in the water. There's going to be a channel opening up there thanks to global warming for seasonal shipping. That place has become the sort of northern circle there, the North Pole region, is going to become a major strategic point for Canada, North America, Nordic countries or Scandinavian countries, Russia, and obviously the Europeans are going to want to get involved. Yeah, and I mean, as you see from the Russians, they're not afraid to take what they like. To get a little crazy, I think there's more than just an insignificant chance of there being major conflict in terms of bang, bang, bullet from a gun kind of conflict because of that area, because it's so strategically vital.
And that's what the segment was about, was about how the various armies of those affected countries or interested countries were all prepping themselves and doing...
Except for Sweden. They can't even find a submarine in their own backyard.
War games, remember?
War games.
That's what John, your other hat is editor of African Defense Review.
Yes.
And you do like your guns and ships and
tanks.
It's
difficult to come out of my tunnel vision and not see war everywhere.
What? I mean... We haven't, correct me if I'm wrong, but we haven't seen a hot war between two sort of advanced military powers, a full-on conflict for a couple of decades. What would one look like now?
I think the closest thing we had was the Georgian War. I think that was probably the nearest damn it thing you would see to there being a conflict between two conventional, at least north in the developmental terms, militaries. And I think what you would see is it would be very, very brutal. And to be honest, I don't think most militaries are actually aware of the cost that it's going to be. It's going to make the Iraq War look like nothing. because you're talking about highly, highly sophisticated weapons of destruction here. There's always the potential for nuclear warfare. I mean, it brings you back to all these Cold War kinds of sort of dilemmas. But I think in the end, you're going to have high, high cost for these regions. And I think states might even be prepared to wage non-nuclear conventional war against each other for these assets. I think a lot of it will be naval-based, but given the area is a large ocean region. And I think in that respect, that's why you start seeing, certainly within Britain, even though it's undergoing heavy military cutbacks, it's launching one of the largest aircraft carriers the world has ever seen. Well, I think it's doing sea trials right now. The Scandinavian nations are building highly sophisticated frigates and destroyers, because I think there's a lot of recognition that this is an area where you need to get involved. But I think the human cost in terms of lives lost is going to be significant. And I think that would be a cost that would be heavily considered. And I think some states would be prepared to go to, certainly Russia, that's for sure.
Because going back to what Steele was saying, I think, I mean, fueling any war, any armed conflict, the real question is there a political motive? And there seems
always,
to be at the moment. Because, I mean, the Russians are basically, they've taken a huge chunk and they claim that that's theirs. And the scary thing for me, and going back to your question there, Simon, is the fact that now you're pitting two very powerful nations against each other, two very powerful nations that seem to be stepping on each other's toes regularly, especially as of late, and that is the US and Russia. I mean, the acrimony between the two nations hasn't been this high since the end of the Cold War.
Yeah. And I think you also can't discount the other little nations, and I think their allegiances shouldn't be taken for granted. I don't think you can say the Scandinavians are necessarily going to align with the EU or North America in a hot war between these two countries.
Especially when there's so much at stake.
Yeah.
In terms of the value of those deposits. And I mean, it could single-handedly, especially for those Scandinavian countries, single-handedly, you know, almost double GDP for them.
And I think it's not like the Cold War where the threat of nuclear warfare was almost a political or ideological threat that hung over everyone. This is an economic interest. This would be, or it already is, a larger strategic tussle for an economically vital point that's going to be incredibly important. And I think with that regard, people will not go to nuclear war, but they're willing to send a couple of fleets and divisions into that area to start actually.
How would you even go about dividing this up like fairly? You know, the Norwegians send Amundsen
submarine
was there,
flags.
And, you know, like, how do you? You know, how would you even decide?
Exactly, I actually totally forgot what my question was going to be. And it was going to be.
Well,
I mean, I promise you.
While you think of that, there is an international precedent for this, where you have, according to your borders, you get an exclusive economic zone, which all of those countries there will have claimed, which extends 200 nautical miles out into the ocean. And that area is yours to plunder and loot and pillage as much as you want.
Sure.
As long as you can enforce it, legally speaking. What happens there is you have a hell of a lot of countries in a very small area where their exclusive economic zones don't extend 200 nautical miles out according to their borders without bumping into each other. And that's where you start getting all kinds of border disputes. Even Angola is having disputes with its neighbors for its tiny little strip of coastland that it's got there because there's oil out there. So they're trying to claim like 200 nautical miles going out.
A radius of 200.
You know, even though the Angolan Navy is not necessarily the greatest thing in the world, but they're claiming it because it's economically useful.
Well, you know, you've got to ask yourself, have we sort of outlived the usefulness of this nation-state concept? I mean, the idea that Moscow or Washington, D.C. should benefit from these resources, which are in the middle of nowhere, there's no human habitation anywhere close. These resources don't belong to those cities, to those governments. Surely we need to be working on some kind of international mechanism for it. I know this is pie in the sky stuff.
You bloody European. Come here with your regional homogenization. Well, the difficulty is when you look at even countries like the UK, this year Cameron said by 2017 we're going to revisit the EU membership question. And I think countries, even now, even European countries who are the picture of non-state or non-national integration and regional integration as well, even then, when the shit hits the fan, to excuse my French, to excuse the pun about the French, when the shit hits the fan, There is talk of secession from the EU and a almost like we're going to be our own country again. And that's worrying because I'm a big fan of the EU and I do agree with you. I think that certainly it's the way to a better global society.
There I agree with you. There completely. For once, John, you and I are sitting No, because and this is the other thing that I've noticed is that there's this increase in nationalism usually when things go wrong. You know, when we're unhappy, when the unemployment is down, when I mean, look at the current South African situation. Exactly. I mean, if things start getting, you know, the more things get worse, the more, unfortunately, if you're Zimbabwe and in South Africa, you're in trouble.
Yeah.
Because it's your fault. You know, despite what the president does, despite the hashtag payback the money and this, that, and the other, it's the Zimbabweans, you know? So and that sentiment, I think, is starting to increase globally. And I just remember what my question was, if I may.
Aha, please.
So, I mean, is Russia then the horse to bet on? Because, I mean, yes, so they said stuff you to the U.S. And in the process, all the economic sanctions, not really a major impact. We still, you know, have the most billionaires in the world, the fastest growing nation with billionaires in the world. Is Russia still the horse to bet on in this
I say no. I say absolutely
Why
not.
Is that?
I think Russia's overextended in the Eastern Europe in its attempts to annex the Donetsk region of the Ukraine. I mean, Crimea was a fantastic pivot that Putin did. He played his hand perfectly, knowing that NATO probably wouldn't do anything. But I think he overextended in Ukraine. And if he tried to do something now, or even in the next 10 to 20 years, militarily speaking, in any other theater, as history has shown us, you don't fight a war in two fronts because you will lose. As America's seen now, Iraq and Afghanistan, you can't do two at the same time. Pick one and you'll probably be okay. But pick two and you'll have a problem, let alone the fact that Russia's going against America and probably Canada and possibly the EU and NATO powers as well. And I think in that regard, I think don't underestimate American ability to fight conventional wars because it's the kind of war that America has been building up to do for the past 60 or 70 years, whereas Russia, they lost all their money at the end of the Cold War, and they've kind of been struggling ever since to resurrect its military ever after Perestroika and Glasnost. And I think they put on a good show, don't get me wrong, and they make the Ukrainians look stupid. But against someone like America, I think people would – I wouldn't put my money in Russia's corner.
I think I'm going to go ahead and bet on China. Mostly because they're not involved. They're just going to sit back, watch Russia and America destroy each other.
As China does.
And, and then walk over everybody. Yeah.
Well, okay. I mean, and that comes back to your piece on China and their involvement in Africa. And, you know, on the face of it, you look at this China's advancement on the continent and their swallowing up of the resources, and you look at it and go, well, I don't really have a problem with it. They're coming in and you know, paying market value for the resources that they're pulling out, as opposed to the colonialism of Britain and France, where they just came in and raped and pillaged and took and enslaved.
We give you and you'll like it.
Yeah. But, you know, the definition of neocolonialism is that it starts, I mean, the influence starts affecting your policies. We just look at the way that, you know, the Dalai Lama isn't allowed to come and visit us. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of economic influence starts creeping into policy and control of these areas. And so it then becomes a bigger issue than just, okay, they're fine, they're coming in paying market value for our resources, but the influence is just becoming so much and everywhere. Corners are being cut, and we're starting to see, you know, it's starting to become worrying.
The question I've been grappling with, because you hear this so often, in any discourse on African issues, you know, the problem with China and Africa is the Chinese who come and they, you know, they don't respect our environmental laws. They don't pay fair wages for the labor. They, you know, they put backhanders in the pockets of our leaders. And then you end up with exactly this kind of influence where the Dalai Lama is not allowed into South Africa. Now, I don't know. It's not for me. You know, I feel this way quite strongly with media as well. I mean, I'm not worried about how the Western media depicts Africa. I'm worried about how African media depicts Africa. And I'm not worried about what China wants to do in Africa. I'm worried about how Africa allows China to do it. Mm-hmm. Now, every example that I've come across where an African president has stood up to China and said, no, you know what, you're going to do it this way, or you're not going to do it at all. A good example is Zambia, when the late Michael Sata took charge. He increased the minimum wage significantly and put in a harsh new set of labor laws. And you know what the Chinese did? The very next day, they started paying the new minimum wage, and they enforced the new labor laws. It's as simple as that.
Yeah, yeah.
And what really would have happened if we'd given the Dalai Lama a visa? Would China really have cut off their relations with South Africa?
Would they have stopped buying our resources?
Absolutely not. So you know, the problem is not China. The problem is us. I'm starting to feel that more and more strongly. The real problem we've got is our own leadership in Africa, and we need to sort that
out
first.
And I think it's – unfortunately, I don't think South Africa is particularly great in this regard either. Dalai Lama being a good case in point. And I think it's almost a failure to understand – our weight in foreign policy terms, and to be able to formulate coherent, I'm talking in a broad African sense here, to formulate coherent foreign policy strategies, especially when it comes to China, where that can actually determine a hell of a lot of your country's economic growth and success. I think it's disturbing.
Yeah. I think it comes down to basic economics. We have something that you want, you can have it, but you're going to play according to our rules. You know, not according to your rules. And I mean, going back to it, the real question is that so, yes, we gave the Dalai Lama the nod and we gave him the visa and we said, please do come and welcome, you know, we welcome you with open arms. Please do visit us. Was anything adverse going to happen to our economy? I don't think so. Yeah. So why are we then? And I think it's more a case of it's not really. You see, the nice thing about the previous type of colonialism was that we didn't really have much of a choice. They had bigger guns and militaries and stuff, and you'd get a clap if we don't cooperate. Now it's a case of we'll play along. No. Please, we'll just play along.
Exactly. We are complicit in this neo-colonialism, if we're going to call it that.
Maybe furry the previous handcuffs. Colonialism really just scared us, you know, and we don't want to get clapped anymore. You know? Like, okay, guys, we'll cooperate. We'll work with you.
It's like a national battered wife syndrome, which is awful.
Guys, have you noticed that this is obviously, you can tell this is our first show back and that South Africa has been pretty much on holiday. We haven't even mentioned any local issues today. You know, so obviously our big newsmakers and our big troublemakers are still sunning themselves or only getting back into scandal mode, you know, which I'm sure we'll pick up from next week onwards. But maybe
Silly, I don't think it's that they haven't been doing the scandals. It's that all the journalists have been on holiday.
Right.
Note to politicians, if you're going to do something, do it in December.
Yeah.
No, but interesting stuff happened in Cape Town, so I'm sure there's going to be a lot to talk about.
Yeah, that's true. And it'll be picking up steam. But maybe just before we wrap up, just a look ahead, or you know, what are the big things on your radar this week or this year in terms of things to watch out for, Simon?
I am going to be focusing a lot on the Nigerian election, which is in February. There's also the Zambian election, but that's not so interesting. The election in Nigeria is huge. It is going to sort of decide the fate of the country for the next 5 or 10 years. I'm pretty sure Goodluck Jonathan is going to retain his seat.
Yeah.
And for me, that means just a accelerated decline, I think.
So basically a second Zuma term equivalent.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Right. Well, a colleague of mine at African Defense Review, Conway Waddington, actually mentioned that it could potentially, I can't emphasize it enough, almost boil down into a Kenya-esque kind of violence because of if Jonathan wins another term. It'd be quite interesting.
Absolutely. I'm very worried about that. Added to that is the fact that Boko Haram has said that voting is also haram.
Oh.
So they will be targeting voters and voting stations, presumably.
We've seen what happens when people are threatened with a vote.
And also what that means is that people aren't going to vote, you know, and especially in the north, where Boko Haram are. I mean, if I was a northerner and Boko Haram said they're going to bomb a polling station, there's no way.
And they're easy targets. Masses of people and probably too many for the military to look after.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's no way you can put a full-on security effort across the entire country in every polling station.
Yeah.
John, what's on your radar?
Something actually completely different and I think a hell of a lot more pleasant is the NFL playoffs are drawing to a close and there's going to be the Super Bowl on the 1st of February. I'm a huge NFL fan and I love watching.
How does that happen? How does a South African become
I'm a huge NFL.
There is. You would be surprised how many South Africans actually really enjoy the NFL series. I mean, they started thankfully putting the playoffs in SuperSport as well. I think you have friends in America who force you to sit for 3 hours, explain the rules to you, and once you understand the rules, I think kind of like rugby, it's actually it becomes a hell of a lot more enjoyable. Yeah. So I think with those, the playoffs are looking to be quite interesting. The last weekend's game with between the Patriots and the Baltimore Ravens were fantastic. It was such a great game, absolutely great game, if you know the rules. Otherwise, it's boring. So I'm following that quite closely, and I'm going to subject all the Daily Maverick readers to that.
I'm a closet fan.
Yeah, Gus, you're a closet fan as well.
I'm a closet fan. Yeah.
Amen. Wait, which team? Hold on.
No, I don't have a particular allegiance yet. It takes some time. You know, I'm a very patriotic bloke. I still support the Lions.
I'm looking forward to the two World Cups, rugby and cricket, and the African Cup of Nations. Hopefully, we can do the triple this year with the Springboks, Proteas, and Bafana. That would be incredible.
Oh,
but
well, you want them all to go out.
No, I'm backing the Proteas because it's the irony of Jacques Callas not being there, carrying the team for the last 18 years, leaves it, and they go and win the World Cup. I could see that irony, and possibly Boy Island have a shot at the World Cup. But that's the wrap up of the first show of the year. You can catch it on iTunes, subscribe to the Daily Maverick show, or get it from the Daily Maverick website and Cliff Central. You can subscribe to the First Thing newsletter or the Daily Dose on Cliff Central. Until next week, thanks for joining us.
Stay informed and up to date. It's the Daily Maverick Show, Tuesdays 1 to 2 p.m. on cliffcentral.com.